frantically.
Open the door. Open the door. Open the door.
I'm trying, Gideon, she sent back, fumbling with her mind in the delicate cylinders of the door's lock. I think I can open it. The lock squeezed tighter. With a gasp of fatigue, Kiss fell back.
Kiss, can I ask you a question?
Of course.
Who's Gideon?
Kiss scrambled back from the hatch into the far corner of the tank. What do you mean? What the hell do you mean, who's Gideon? Who am I talking to?
Don't be like that, Kiss.
Who am I talking to? The handle of the tank door began to move by itself, jerking impotently up and down. A sheen of ice suddenly crackled across the face of the door, forming slow, lazy crusts across the metal. Laughter, manic and wild, began to echo out of the keyhole.
You know who I am,
the voice said. Chapter 9. Medike Ludmila Bashisvili was a tall, scrawny woman in her late 50s. She had spent too much of her career treating dog troop guardsmen for clap, ear infections, and sprains. She entered the infirmary, and her gaze fell on the battered chair, her hands tucked into the front pocket of her smock. What the hell is this? She asked. I'm a doctor, not a tech adept.
It's a life support system, said Nail, standing nearby under the careful watch of two armed troopers. Angharad and Ayasob had already been taken away into detention.
Lang had allowed Nail to stay with Ravener.
And who might you be?
Bashisvili asked.
My name is Harlan Nail,
Nail replied.
Oh, fancy, said Bashisvili. Tough guy, I suppose.
You mean me or the chair? Asked Nail.
Bashisvili bent down and examined the chair. She peered at it and ran her hands over the chair's surface, touching the dent wounds and scratches. She wiped an index finger into some of the discharged fluid, sniffed it, and made a face.
Does he speak?
Ordinarily, but his voxponder is broken. He sends to me.
He's a psyker.
Nail nodded. Bashisvili exhaled and stood upright, putting her hands on her hips.
He's dying. That much is clear. Critical impairment to the support system and the device's integument.
She gently steered the chair into the diagnosis bay, pushing aside the gurney where her more regular patients usually reclined. Nail watched her. Bashisvili turned on a number of the devices, including an array of raised scanner pads held upright on a chrome frame. She bent a few of them over to better address the chair. Monitor screens lit up on the display consoles, and she studied them. Then she took out a paddle sensor and ran it over the casing.
This is thick armor, she said. I dread to think what might have punched holes in plating this tough. Trouble is, it's so thick, I'm not getting any kind of useful imaging through it.
What can you do? Asked Nail.
I could attempt to link up an external life support system to stabilize him. But
she bent down to examine the recessed ports and ducts in the chair's back.
But
looks like the connectors and feeds are non-standard fitting. This chair is a custom build, so that's no good. It'd be a stopgap anyway. To attempt to save him, I'll have to get in there.
No, said Nail firmly. He doesn't allow that.
The armed guards either side of him tensed, ready to restrain him.
Does he allow himself to die? Bashisvili asked Nail.
What?
I simply can't help him if I can't get in there. Will he allow that, if his life is in the balance?
Nail shrugged.
He's an Imperial Inquisitor. His name is Gideon Ravener. As far as I know, he hasn't been out of that chair since he was placed in it.
How long ago?
Decades. He is a private person.
I'm a Medike, said Bashisvili. We reach out our own understandings.
She ran her hands over the cowling of Ravener's chair again. The hatch banged open. It was Lang and two more troopers.
Colonel, said Bashisvili, straightening up and saluting.
Doctor?
Lang nodded. She looked at Nail.
We have consulted with the local Ordos. They're searching their records. So far they cannot find any trace of your credentials. Nice try. The badge had me fooled.
Colonel,
Nail began.
They're still checking, Lang said, and signals have been sent astropathically to nearby sector conclaves. I have been promised an answer with all due haste.
But realistically, this could take days, even weeks. In the meantime, sir, I have to presume the worst and deprive you of your liberty.
Please, said Nail.
This is wartime, said Lang, and wartime rules apply. I cannot take post-security anything less than seriously. The rebels have attacked this station before and may do it again, at any moment. She stared at Nail. They may already be here. Take him to the cell block, Lang told the guards. They marched Nail out of the room.
This one needs attention, Colonel, Bashesvili said. He's in a poor state.
Do what you can to make him fit for interrogation, said Lang.
The colonel and her escort left. The hatch closed. Alone, Bashesvili looked down at the battered chair.
Where possible, she said, I'd like to establish a dialogue with my patients.
A tiny rasp of response came from the machine.
You know, said Bashesvili.
Does it hurt? Doesn't it hurt? Say ah, type of thing.
There was another tiny gasp.
I shouldn't do this, said Bashesvili, but I'm willful, and menopausal, and at the bad end of a long drudge tour out here on Rajes.
She reached up into her hairline and slowly unscrewed her blocker implant. She set it down on the polished table beside her.
Is that better? Hello in there.
It is better. Can you hear me?
Extraordinary. Yes, I can. You're strong. Like a song in my head. You have a nice voice. Mellow. You were a handsome devil, weren't you?
I don't know.
Yes, you were, once. I can tell. Now, what's your name?
Gideon.
Hello, I'm Ludmilla. Don't you dare think of messing with my head now. You understand? I have a responsibility here.
I won't. I promise. Believe me, Ludmilla. All I want is for this pain to stop.
Yeah, well, you're screwed. I can tell just by the whiff of you. You're rotting inside that box. I need to open you up. Your friend seemed to think that was a no-go. What do you say?
I say, I can't hold on much longer, Ludmilla.
That's a start, she said. She reached over and swung in a hinged table of sterile tools. What happens? Do you open your case, or do I have to crack it with a cutter?
Wait.
What for? She asked. She wiped at her face suddenly, as if cobwebs had brushed against it. What are you doing? I can feel that. What are you doing?
Forgive me. I was looking into your mind.
Oh, kindly don't do it again. She paused, and then asked, What did you see?
I saw enough to know I can trust you. I have to trust you. I will open the casing. Please, don't be distressed by what you see inside.
Bloody hell, Gideon, she snorted. You haven't got anything I haven't seen before. How does the casing open?
Ravenna didn't reply. There was a slow hiss of releasing catches, and the upper part of his chair slowly lifted away. Vapor oozed out. A dull blue light shone from the open cavity.
Oh, Gideon, she said, peering inside. Oh, you poor man.
She turned, pulled on surgical gloves, and looked back into the cavity.
I think I'm going to have to call for interns to help me so I can...
No interns. No one else. Just you.
Ow, she said. Not so fierce with the sending, please.
I'm sorry, but please...
All right, if that's what you want.
She bent down and reached into the cup of warm, stagnant fluid. She circled her arms underneath Ravenna's physical form.
Have I got you? Are you supported?
Yes.
Bashesvili lifted him out of the chair. Tiny ducting relays and drip feeds, clustered in their thousands, like fronds of hair, pulled away.
No. It's all right, Gideon, she soothed.
Shush, shush, it's all right. I've got you. Gideon.
The wet, blood-smeared, respiring sack of pale flesh she held in her arms had gone very quiet.
Gideon?
They don't believe us, snarled Angharad.
No.
They don't believe us, she repeated.
No, said Nail. Now hush, I'm thinking.
We're 1,000 years out,
said Ayasob from the corner of the cell.
That's an awfully long way.
I know it is, said Nail. That means a confirmation of our status is never going to come, because we don't exist yet. I was just hoping that we could delay them. It's ironic. The Rosette is genuine, but to them, it's a fake. Now, shut up, both of you, and let me think. Ow! He said almost immediately. Spiky pain had jabbed into his head.
I feel that too, said Angharad, massaging her temples.
It's Gideon, said Nail, rising. It's Gideon. He's hurting.
Maybe, said Angharad. But didn't they warn us? Something about the thorns after dark?
Night had fallen outside. Through the small, barred slit of a window, they could hear the thornbrush, the cucud, around the compound, whispering and rustling.
Oh, great, Nail growled. All right, our choices have just been reduced to one.
Which is?
We bust out of here.
Angharad gazed at him with steady, hooded eyes.
Far be it for me to mention a few ifs, but...
But?
If we can open that cell hatch, if we can evade the guards without getting gunned down, if we can find a way out of the compound, and if Ravana is fit enough to accompany us...
Reach a point, please, woman, Nail said.
If your good friend Gideon is hurt and can't be moved, will you leave him here?
No,
said Nail.
Then there's no point breaking out. It would be signing our own death warrant. To escape and then not flee.
Nail sighed and leaned his back against the cell wall. He slid down it until he was sitting on the floor. Angharad presumed he had given up.
Are all Carthayan women so pessimistic? He asked. I thought you were a warrior.
A good warrior knows when to fight, said Angharad.
And a better one knows when to improvise.
Nail countered. He'd sat down to tug off one of his boots.
What is he doing?
Asked Ayasob, sitting up to watch. Angharad shrugged. Lang's guards had searched them all and scanned them scrupulously for metallics and concealed weapons. They'd found Nail's boot knife, the coil of multipurpose wire he carried around his waist, and the small pebble charge he kept in a wrist pocket. He levered open the heel of his boot and carefully teased something out of the rubberized sole. It was a slim jemmy pick made of inert plastic.
This answers your first if, he said, holding it up. This opens the hatch. The points you raised were good, and I can't argue with them, but we still have to do this.
And when the hatch opens? She asked.
Like I said, we improvise, he grinned. I'm good at that.
Angharad nodded.
One of the few things I like about you.
If this is how I am going to die, I am strangely happy about it. To be free one last time. To be outside the chair. To feel the air on my skin. I cannot say what fate I expected, but it was certainly some titanic doom, suffered in the service of the Ordos. I suppose this is exactly that in a way, but it's also a calm end, and a free one. The plight we are in seems so very far away. The impossible divorce from our own place-time. It fades, and seems insubstantial. I fade, too. Stay awake. Stay awake. All that seems important anymore is lying here, in the cool air. I'm feeling the useless dying body I own twitch and tremble as Ludmilla Bashisvili works. She is breathing hard. I can feel her tension. I can also feel her devotion. She has fixed various links to my circulatory systems and organs. I can hear machines beeping and chiming. I can feel a warm glow, which I presume is either anesthetic or the infeed of intravenous fluids and blood. I can also feel a scratching around the edges of my mind. Ludmilla feels it too, and it bothers her. The cucud. Night has fallen, and the brush is active outside. It is not a sentience, just a dry, gristly hiss of residual psychic activity. It is not unpleasant, just irritating. Like a chorus of insects. A vast body of psi-responsive matter, like a sponge.
Gideon, she asks, putting a bloody tool down in a steel dish with a clatter. With me, still?
Yes.
Good,
she says. She's lying. I go free for a moment and see the world through her eyes. I see the shrunken, twisted thing that is me lying on the surgery table. Bunches of squirting pipes and sucking tubes intrude into me through catheters. I have not seen myself in the flesh for a long time. Poor withered flesh. A wrinkled sack of organs and redundant bones, the vague, vestigial remains of a human face, sunk low like a tumor on the top of the sack. God Emperor, how did I ever survive the Thracian atrocity? God Emperor, why did you let me survive? I see the discolored flesh, the atrophied ends of truncated joints. I see the pallor of my burned tissue skin, the cicatrice scars of my original surgery. I notice also the patches of black bruising and necrotization creeping across my form like the shadows of leaves on the ground. I see the wounds the hooked things made, pussy and raw, like gaping mouths. I was hurt even more than I thought. Ludmilla has just removed a hank of hook bone 10 centimeters long from what I once called my belly. She drops it into a bowl in disgust. The great devourer. My mind swims. There is pain, but beyond the pain, there is a solace, which I think might be death. Ludmilla threads a needle. I have to stay awake. I know this. I know this. I look into her. I slide through reefs of sadness and concern that part easily because she is concentrating elsewhere. The life of a field medicae is no life, I quickly realize. Hers has been long and unrewarding. Thought engrams dazzle and open. I see her siblings in the family home, laughing children, a cherished nugget of memory. A blue dress. Her father's posting. Her father's death. I see a bad marriage and a few disastrous love affairs. I see a child she lost. I am a voyeur. I should care and be ashamed of myself, but I'm not. The front of her mind is locked in effort. The back drifts like a warm sea, forgotten. I see the war. 30 years long already. Rebels on Vida have risen in the cause of emancipation. Imperial secessionists. The guard has locked the systems down. Protracted fighting on 3 worlds. Rumors of guard-sanctioned massacres. A dirty war. The Imperium fighting itself. No wonder Asa Lang was driven. The arch-enemy, the Greenskin, the Eldar, all terrible foes. But I know, ultimately, there is no more bitter and distressing enemy than our own kind, when humans turn on humans. Ludmilla loathes it. Ah, I see. Her family was from Vida. She hates this posting more. Rajes, right on the front. A listening watch. Frontline defenders, alert and wired all the time. She hates this. She hates it most of all because of the Kakud, the whispering thorn. Isolated out here, humans would be paranoid anyway. The brush makes it worse. I wish I could soothe her. I... Gideon, are you still with me? I felt that.
I'm here.
My voice is less than a whisper. She has just extracted another chip of broken hook bone. It clinks into a bowl.
I'm worried about your vitals, Gideon. Please, try to stay here with me.
I will.
The Kakud is scratching at my mind. I wish I could blank it, but I can't. It's like a chorus, an insensate chorus. It resonates. As I push up into it, it rustles back. Sentient or not, it amplifies my thoughts as echoes. Throne, I could...
Gideon! Gideon!
I think I blacked out for a moment.
Yes. The table-mounted Kron has skipped 8 minutes. 8.
Ludmilla.
Gideon! Oh, for throne's sake, I thought I'd frigging lost you.
Language.
She laughs. Ludmilla has a good laugh. The men she courted would have loved her for that. Why did she never find one good enough to keep?
I feel so distant now. I feel...
Gideon, come back to me, you bastard!
I'm still here.
I'm going to have to go deeper in this wound. You're going to have to be strong. Can you stand this?
Yes.
Concentrate on something. Focus on it.
Yes. I focus on... I drift. I try to remember what I am supposed to be doing. Everything is so vapid and thin. I think of Nail, of Kiss, of Kara. I think of Will. He's dead. I know he's dead. Moloch killed him. I think of Moloch, and some measure of focus returns. Zygmunt Moloch. But for him, I would not be here. But for him, my life would have been entirely different. I feel a passionate hatred. The energy lifts me up.
That's better. Good vitals. Now, this is going to really hurt.
Moloch. Moloch. I want him. I want to finish him. 1,000 years and half a galaxy away, I remember him. And want to finish him. He did this to me. He put me here.
Gideon, your pulse rate is all off. Gideon!
The Kakud. The door. I can see it now. Now I can see it, and...
Gideon!
I can see it. Throne. I'm fading fast. I can tell. Each instrument Ludmilla pushes into me tastes different. The salt tang of the scalpel... The iron hit of the tweezers. The bleach sip of the retractors. Oh, throne. Oh, throne. I am really dying. But I can see it now. Oh, how I can see it. The door. The key. The Kukud. I send it into Ludmilla's mind. If only I could... If only I could...
Ow!
She cries, jolting up.
Stop it with that!
If only I could... If only I could... If only I could... If only I could... If...
Bashasvili jerked back from the operating table. Gideon! She asked. Every single monitor device around her stopped pinging and wailed out a flatline drone.
No!
She cried. Chapter 10. There was a bumping scrape of metal on metal, and the service boat locked into the docking clamps of the Allure. Servitors and deck wranglers began to move around, shouting back and forth as they started loading the modular crates of perishables and victuals onto the through-deck cargo hoists. Hydraulics sighed, bulk hatches opened, vapor drifted. The cargo area was dark and lit only by frosty amber overheads. Kara swung down from a crawl space above a large duct circulator where she had hung, concealed, during the ride from the orbital station. Keeping low, she ran along the edge of the hold's raised loading pad, and then swung over onto one of the laden hoists as it started to rise. The hoist rose into the bulk hold of the rogue trader Allure. The air smelled of spices and rotting fruit. Crewmen and servitors were busy unloading one of the crate stacks, moving some of the containers on trolleys through to adjacent secondary holds. Kara slipped off the hoist into the shadows. She was wearing a black body glove with a tight hood to conceal her red hair. Crewmen strolled past her, chatting. She could smell their sweat, the stale low scent clinging to their work clothes. She shifted to a second hiding place and tucked in. From her position, she could see the main floor of the hold. There was Siskind himself, in his glass jacket, a cruelly handsome, red-haired man. He was talking to the master of the service boat,
and signing off a manifest. Kara had been aboard the Allure once before, when the Hinterlight had seized her and inspected her en route to Lenk. That seemed like a lifetime ago, but she still had a pretty good memory of the layout. She waited for a suitable lull in the activity nearby, and then made another dash along the side access to a companionway hatch. The hall beyond the hatch was quiet and empty. She darted through and headed forwards. It took her 10 minutes to make her way up 3 decks. 5 times she had to find cover as crew members came by. By her estimation, the bridge was not far off. She hurried forwards, then heard footsteps and voices approaching. She looked around. There was nowhere to hide. Lucius Vorner clanged down the companionway at Siskin's side. He towered over the shipmaster. The ugly wounds he had taken at the witch house had been left untreated, and had begun to scab in black, scaly patches.
"How long now?" he asked.
30 minutes, and we'll be shot of the last supplier," Siskind replied. "Then another hour as we light the engines, disengage anchors, and calculate the last of the mass velocity transactions. I thought I'd take supper now. Will you join me?"
Vorner grunted. They reached the far end of the companionway, and Siskind swung open the hatch. Vorner stopped and looked back.
"What?" asked Siskind.
Vorner stared back down the empty walkway. He shrugged.
"I thought I smelt something."
"Like what?"
Siskind asked. Vorner shook his head.
"Doesn't matter," he said.
They passed through the hatch and out of sight. Kara breathed out. She dropped down out of the ceiling space and landed on her feet. Too close. 30 minutes, she'd heard Siskind say. If she wanted to be on that service boat when it left, that's how long she had. The bridge, wide and low-ceilinged, was almost empty. Systems were cycling on automatic standby. Kara waited in the shadows as the Allure's first officer, Ornales, she seemed to recall him being called, checked over some console displays with 2 of his men. Then all 3 disappeared towards the navigation chamber. The data was there, on the main console that extended down from the ceiling over the master's seat, blocks of information glowing on the repeater screen. She scrolled down carefully, reading off, until she was sure she was sure. Voices. She ducked down behind the master's seat. She heard Ornales return and walked through the bridge with his 2 companions. They left through the hatch she had entered by. Kara rose again and crept across to the comm station. The high-gain vox was of an unfamiliar design, but she made sense of it. She set the band, altered the directional array slightly, and selected signal stroke non-voice. Very carefully, she typed her message on the worn, yellowing keys. Dancer wishes nest. Gudrun. She pressed transmit. The machine warbled to itself quietly, and the words she'd entered on the display disappeared, to be replaced by signal sent. She turned and headed for the exit. She had, by her own maths, less than 10 minutes remaining. It had taken her longer than that to reach the bridge. She ran down the bridge link companionway, across a 4-way junction, and turned left down an access walk. She heard voices a long way behind her, but nothing close. A ladder well took her down through the deck and onto a lateral access. The mess was nearby. She could smell boiled vegetables and grease. She hurried on to the next hatchway. She was just a few meters away from it when Lucius Vorner stepped out into the light, blocking the hatch. He stared at her with malicious intent. She backed away fast and turned. Siskind was standing 10 meters behind her. The red-haired man wore a strange, satisfied smile. He was aiming a las pistol at her, straight-armed.
"Hello," he said. "Or, as I should say, goodbye."
"That's never going to open, is it?" asked Angharad, watching Nail work. Nail sat back from the cell door and shook his head. He had been working so intently that his scalp was beaded with perspiration. The plastic jemmy was twisted out of shape and deformed.
"Let me give it one more."
"You've been saying that for an hour," Angharad said.
"He isn't ever going to open it," said Aya Sob. "Keys are funny things, and that's not a key."
"Be quiet, child," Angharad spat.
"She's right,"
said Nail, rising to his feet. He turned his back on the cell door and hurled the useless jemmy away with a grunt of frustration. It hit the far wall and dropped onto the floor. Outside, The Kakud was hissing and scratching in the darkness. There was a soft thump, a click of retracting bolts, and the cell door swung open.
"Very good,"
cried Ayasob, clapping her hands. Nail turned slowly around.
"That wasn't me," he said.
Ludmilla Bashisvili peered in at them.
"There's very little time," she whispered. "Come on."
The three of them stared at her.
"Are you? What are you doing? Are you springing us?"
Nail asked.
"Yes,"
whispered Bashisvili, impatiently.
"Come on!"
"What about Ravana?"
Nail demanded. Bashisvili looked at him.
"I'm sorry. I have just informed Colonel Lang. Your friend Gideon died 15 minutes ago on the operating table."
"If you sat down, perhaps?" Thonius suggested.
"No thanks," replied Belknap, and continued pacing the bridge.
"I'm not thinking of you so much," said Thonius. "You pacing up and down is starting to piss me off."
Belknap glared at him.
"We should have heard something by now," said Pleiton. "What's taking her so long?"
"Just wait," said Balak.
"She'll be fine. She..."
Unworth, hunched over the master control, made a small sound.
"What?"
asked Belknap, switching around to face him.
"What?"
Unworth pointed dismally at the display with a disfigured hand.
"The Allure just lit its drive,"
said Pleiton, staring.
"No,"
said Belknap.
"Come on, Kara. Come on! By the grace of the throne and the blessing of the God Emperor!"
"It's left Grav Anchorage,"
Pleiton whispered. She rose to her feet, staring at the plot display.
"Oh, no."
"She's running," said Balak, "accelerating onto an out-system vector."
"Kara!" Belknap howled, helplessly. The Allure was departing. There was nothing they could do. The Vox Bank behind Thonius chimed. Part 4. End of story. Chapter 1. Patience Kiss remained in the brig aboard the Arethusa for 13 days. In part, her stay was enforced. In part, voluntary. On the first day of her incarceration, less than an hour after the terrifying voice had spoken to her from the keyhole, she felt the deck shiver. Various rumbles and vibrations followed, and she knew they were casting off. The main drives cycled up until the air filled with a long, throbbing background hum. An hour after that, she felt the brief, disconcerting shudder of translation. Several hours later, the tank door swung open, and Thonius came in with a mess tray of food and a flask of water. He set them down on the end of the tank's small cot and looked at her.
"Do you need anything else?"
he asked, stiffly.
"A book, perhaps?" "I need to be let out of here," she said.
He sighed.
"Kiss, I can't do that. You know I can't."
"Listen to me, Carl, please," Kiss said quickly, rising to her feet. "Zael represents an absolute threat to us. Every second we waste brings us closer to disaster. You know what Gideon thought about the boy."
"I know he didn't kill him immediately," said Carl. "I know he left the boy alive and gave him the benefit of the doubt."
"That doubt is gone.
Ravana left Frauke.
Frauke is compromised. Zael is awake. The demon is here, waking, among us."
Thonius smiled sadly.
"Patience, old thing, I feel for you, I really do. I know you think you're right, but I'll tell you what's really happening.
Gideon is dead. You are undermined by grief and a mistaken feeling of responsibility.
You are not thinking clearly. You're reacting too extremely. It's understandable. You think you let Ravana down in life, and you're trying not to do the same now he's dead."
"Do I pay extra for the COD psychoanalysis?"
she asked. He pouted.
"This has been a bad, bad time for all of us. Don't make it worse by lashing out at phantoms."
"You won't let me out?"
"Can I trust you not to try and kill Zael again?"
She didn't answer.
"Well, at least you didn't try to lie to me," he said. "You have to stay in here for now, for your own safety as much as Zael's. Maybe in a day or two..."
"I'll have calmed down, seen sense."
"You need time to reflect."
Kiss stared at him.
"Just a few hours ago, it spoke to me. It spoke to me through the door."
What did?
She swallowed.
Slight.
Thonius shook his head.
I experienced a major psychic event, she insisted.
One that nobody else felt. One that didn't set off any of the ship's detectors.
Please, Carl. Please. I'm begging you. Examine Zale yourself. Examine Frauke, too. He's lying. He's protecting the boy. Please, tell me you'll check it yourself. We are all in danger and...
Eat some food. Get some rest,
he said, moving back towards the door. She sat down heavily on the cot.
Where are we going?
She asked.
Gudrun.
Why?
It's where we believe Moloch is.
Why?
She repeated.
Information received. Look, I've got things to do.
Let me talk to Kara, then.
A strange expression crossed his face.
I'll check back later,
he said. She slept for a while. As Kara had warned her, the quality of her sleep was not good. Flocks of whispers circled her dreams, like the eerie twittering of the witch house. Thonius returned 6 hours later with another tray and removed the first. She'd picked at the meal.
Will you let me out? She asked.
Will you try to kill Zale?
She shrugged.
I'll see you in the morning.
Where's Kara?
She asked. With great reluctance, he told her how Kara had boarded the Allure, obtained the information they needed, and never returned. The news knifed shock into her. Coming so soon after the hammerblow of Ravenna's death, it seemed extravagantly cruel and unnecessary. She wept inconsolably, tormented by a feeling of helplessness. Thonius made some half-hearted soothing noises and then left her alone. Kiss continued to weep for hours. She was so racked with sobs it seemed that she was crying out her own grief, as well as the grief Ravenna would have expressed if he had lived to witness Kara's fate. The pattern was repeated for the next 10 days. Carl Thonius visited her twice each day, bringing her food and water, and the occasional book or data slate, none of which she read. She would ask to be released, and he would ask her if she still intended to hurt Zale. She would beg him to take her seriously, and he would tell her to rest and reflect. It was always Thonius. He never made the mistake of sending Belknap or Frauke, either of whom she would have had no hesitation in trying to overpower. Carl Thonius was canny. He clearly understood this, and understood that she would not raise a hand against him. The things he knew. Neither Plighton nor Unworth was sent to look in on her with food. Kiss suspected Thonius didn't trust either of them to be unsympathetic. The rest of the time was largely silent, apart from the throb of the gunning drive. Several times she thought about trying the door again, certain she had recouped enough strength to manipulate the lock. The memory of the whispering voice dissuaded her every time. The voice, mercifully, never returned, although the whispers haunted her edgy dreams, and on more than one occasion, wide awake, she heard distant laughter coming from nowhere. On the 12th day, the ship shuddered, and the tone of the drive altered, and she knew they had returned to normal space. Carl came in 2 hours later, but he seemed preoccupied, and his visit was brief. Pausing only long enough to comment that she wasn't eating enough as he picked up the last tray, he left and locked the door. After that, no one came at all. The drone of the drive cut out, and the Arethusa fell silent. Kiss paced. She waited. The silence bore down on her, total silence, apart from the sporadic stress creaks and groans of the settling hull. When the next visit was missed, Kiss drank the rest of her water and ate what remained of the last meal. Anxiety had robbed her of her appetite for 11 days. Now the waiting made her ravenous. When she was sure she was in the 13th day of imprisonment, she went to the tank door and banged her fist on it, calling out. She did this for some minutes. No one answered. Scared, she sat down in the corner of the cell furthest from the door and waited. The hours ticked slowly by. She woke with a start, still sitting in the corner. Something had woken her. Some noise. She listened. She reached out cautiously with her mind. The first howl came out of nowhere. It lasted 10 seconds and was essentially pure psychic noise. It was like some great beast bellowing in pain, or the throat roar of an apex predator. The first touch of it was so loud, so fierce, that her mind recoiled in shock. The echo of the howl lingered in the ship's hull. Eyes wide in fear, she made herself as small as possible, arms around her upthrust knees. Her body was bathed in cold sweat, fear sweat, and her mind was sore from just that brief touch. She could hear her heart pounding like a marching drum. A second howl split the air. The deck vibrated with its intensity. Kiss whimpered involuntarily, viced by an extreme terror she had never known before. Ice rime formed around the edges of the tank door and glistened at the keyhole. A third howl issued, longer and more anguished than either of the first two. She heard hatches bang and footsteps running past along the hallway outside. Someone was shouting, but she couldn't hear what. Someone else shouted back. Silence. More shouting. Distant footsteps, running along a deck above. Then an odd piping sound that she finally, fearfully realized was a muffled, persistent screaming. She dared not reach out with her mind. Everything went quiet for an agonizing 30 or 40 minutes. The ice around the door melted into glinting spots of dew. Just when she thought nothing more would come, there was a fourth, dreadful, psychic roar, and then a fifth, the longest of all. It was followed by a long, painful bout of sobbing. A man was wailing somewhere, wailing with his mind. She grimaced and tried to shut it out. The sobs clawed at the edges of her thoughts until they became frayed. The sobbing faded. More shouting began, real voices shouting. Kiss jumped at the sudden boom of a gun, a shotgun or an auto rifle. It fired 4 times in quick succession. Someone shouted distantly, and then a barrage of angry voices started up, yelling over one another. The shotgun fired again. A lasgun wailed. Then silence drifted back into place. She could bear it no longer. Kiss rose and slowly approached the door, swallowing her fear back. It was like a bolus of food stuck in her throat, choking her. She was 3 meters from the tank door when the most terrifying event of her life took place. The center of the steel door, at a little above waist height, began to bulge, as if the metal was alive. The bulge pushed in towards her, and she backed away. An impression formed. Bared teeth. The frontal dentition, upper and lower, of an adult male's skull, complete with chin bone below and traces of nasal bone above. There was no sign of eye sockets or forehead. It was as if the door had become a taut, flexible skin of rubber, and someone on the other side was pushing the lower part of an incomplete skull into it. Something hit Kiss from behind. It was the rear wall of the tank. She had backed away as far as it was physically possible to go. The imprint of the skull's smile bulged in further, until it was hand's breadth proud of the door's surface. It became even more clearly defined. The metal strained around it. "The Emperor protects," Kiss stammered. "The Emperor protects." The skull's smile slowly opened its jaws. Then it pulled away sharply and vanished. The door became flat again. Kiss kept staring at the door. After a second or two, the smile reappeared, bulging in at a different, higher part of the door. It opened and closed its jaws twice. It withdrew as rapidly as before, and then reappeared lower down. This time it writhed back and forth as it opened and closed, turning to the left, to the right, biting at the air. Kiss could hear sobbing, loud and close. The smile withdrew again. Ice sweat trickled down the door's surface, twinkling and glittering like frost. It formed a crust, like on the inside of a refrigeration unit, and then the caked bulk of it collapsed under its own weight and shattered across the cell floor in a shower of snowy debris. Her back to the rear wall of the tank, Kiss slid down and began to shake. The Arethusa stayed quiet for a long time after that. There was no more sobbing or shouting or gunshots, no more howling. The door did not smile at her again. Kiss got up, walked towards the door, and listened. Nothing. She breathed in, exhaled, and quickly reached her mind into the lock. Fear and fury, in equal measure, fueled her with a clinical precision. She seized the lock, scorching the tips of her mind's tendrils on the anti-psi wards, and rattled the tumblers into place. The lock slumped open with a heavy clack, and she mind-wrenched the bolt back. Kiss touched the edge of the door with the tip of one shoe, and it swung open heavily. Her 13-day stay in the Arethusa's brig had come to an end. She walked along the grim, poorly lit hallway of the brig block. Nothing howled, nothing sobbed, nothing smiled. The air was close and warm, as if the ship's air pumps had shut down. She looked for a weapon, but the best she could find was a set of keys hanging on a peg. She took the old heavy keys off their ring and put them in a pocket. In an emergency, she could kind them. She stole through the brig's half-open outer hatch onto the grill mesh of the lower third access. There was no sign of anything in either direction. The access was lit by wall globes, one or two of which were flickering on and off like candle flames guttering in a draught. Her spike heels caught in the deck mesh, so she slipped her shoes off and carried them. Padding forwards in stocking feet, she reached a junction. Ahead, the short, bulk-headed passage to the aft air gate. Left, a flicker-lit companionway turned back to the enginarium. To the right, a corridor led forwards. She turned right. 10 meters along, she found a spilled box of shotgun cartridges, a discarded boot, and a damp towel. The air was still very stale. More of the glow globes and lumen panels were flickering on and off. Kiss bent down and pressed her hand against the cast-iron wall, low down. There was no vibration at all, no throb of power plant, or of idling drive. Although the air was foggy, it was getting colder. The Arethusa was like a cooling corpse. At the next junction, she reached a wall-mounted intercom, a recessed speaker cone with a brass switch. She put her shoes down and reached out for the switch. It took her a long time to pluck up the courage to push it. Click. A long, empty sigh of dead leaves and static breathed out of the speaker. She took her finger off the switch, and the sound went dead. She pressed the switch again, and said, into the rustling, "Hello?" The static shushed her. "Hello? Anyone?" Somewhere, far away, behind the hiss of dry leaves, a man started sobbing. Kiss took her finger off the switch and killed the sound. At the next junction, there was a fire control point riveted to the hull. She helped herself to the heavy, saw-toothed fire axe hanging over the sandbox. Axe in one hand, shoes in the other, she continued on her way. The Arethusa's small excursion bay was empty. The docking clamps were vacant. Neither of the ship's two battered landers were present. Kiss stood on the overlook platform for a while, staring down into the open vault. The heavy-duty docking clamps, thick with black grease and lubricant jelly, stared back at her. Some of the fueling hoses on the right-hand side of the bay had been disconnected in a hurry. Pools of spilled fuel covered the deck plates. "Where did everyone go?" she asked, out loud. She didn't dare ask her real question. Why did everyone go? Halfway along the companionway leading to the forward junction, she found a place where the wall plates had been dented and scorched by gunfire. The marks were fresh, carbonized. A meter or two further along, there was a smeared streak of blood on the wall and a track of drops leading away down the tunnel. Wall lights blinked on and off, strobing maniacally. She bent down. The blood was cold. She entered the infirmary. She put her shoes on before she did, because the floors in the upper decks were solid plate. She slithered in slowly, her axe raised. The outer surgery was empty. Water drizzled out of a half-open tap into a scrub bowl. She turned the faucet off. The doors to the farm cupboards were open, and the contents ransacked. Pill boxes littered the floor. She was crunching over scattered capsules, grinding them to powder. She could hear a soft, panting, purring sound. Kiss nudged the adjoining door open with the head of her axe. The panting grew louder.
She reached out, but her mind touched nothing at all. She entered the wardroom. The air stank of Frauke's low sticks, a cold, distant, tarnished aftersmell. There was nobody in the wardroom. Zale's cot was empty. The plug feeds and drip tubes that had been keeping him alive were draped over the crumpled bed, leaking fluids. The life support unit he had been attached to was grinding and rattling, its lung bellow rising and falling with a dry pant. Cardiac systems and brainwave monitors purred aimlessly. Kiss walked over to the cot. She scraped the sheets back with the blade of her fire axe, although she knew the cot was empty. She reached over and turned off the relentless life support unit. The bellows ceased their panting and became still. The monitors buzzed. Viscous fluid squirted out of the lank tubes left on the bed. A flatline alarm began to ping. She wrenched the unit away from the wall to make it shut up. The bellows flapped and sighed. Silence returned. She walked around the cot and sat down in Frauke's chair. His dish of Lobuts sat on the bedside cabinet. The last one had burnt itself out in a long, perfect column of white ash. His data slate was on the floor in front of the chair. It was still switched on, the battery low warning flashing. She reached down and picked it up.
"He slowly, hungrily, licked the juice off her ample," she read out.
She switched the data slate off and hurled it at the wardroom wall. It broke and fell in pieces. She rose and then sat down again. She'd seen something on the floor beside the bedside cabinet. She reached down with her mind and picked it up. It hovered in front of her face. It was Frauke's auto pistol. Kiss took hold of it with her hand and thumbed out the clip. Full. She looked down at the floor again. It was littered with blood-soaked swabs.
"Oh, you stupid, stupid bastard," she said.
The Arethusa's bridge was as empty as everything else on the ship. She walked in, Frauke's pistol in one hand, the fire axe in the other. The viewers and repeater screens flicked and scrolled mindlessly. Auto systems chattered on and off like muffled gunfire. "Hello?" she called out, hoping for an answer and no answer at the same time. Kiss sat down in the master's chair, put down her pistol and her axe, and began tapping the keys of the main station board. "Gudrun," the screen told her. They were at high anchor above Gudrun, in the Helicon sub. The ship had been set to dormancy. She punched some keys and corrected that. Cool air began to hiss through the air scrubbers. She heard the power plant wake up. She heard distant sobbing, too, but she ignored it. "Replay, recent, log," she typed. The console blinked and replied, "Void." She repeated her command. "Void." She was about to type again when she heard a tiny sound. It came from behind her, in the companionway leading up into the bridge. Kiss picked up the auto pistol and slid down behind the master's chair, aiming the weapon. She picked the axe up, too, with her telekinesis, and lifted it into the ceiling above, just under the roof stanchions. It began to spin, chopping around like a murderous propeller. She heard another sound, a footstep. Someone stepped onto the bridge. Her index finger pulled at the trigger. Sholto Unworth peered at her.
"Hello?" he said.
Kiss rammed the pistol down so that it fired into the thick deck. "Sorry, sorry," she exclaimed. He blinked at her, baffled, flinching from the retort of the shot. She dropped the gun and ran to him, hugged him tightly, and kissed him.
"I'm very glad to see you," she exclaimed.
He stared back at her, lips slightly parted in surprise as hers pulled away. She let him go. She coughed and brushed the front of his jacket as if to smooth it.
"Master Unworth?"
"Patience?"
"It's really good to see you again. I thought I was alone up here."
"You kissed me,"
he frowned.
"Yes, I did. I did kiss you. Sorry."
"Do not be apoplectic. It was unexpectorant."
"Well, forgive me. I'm just happy to see a friendly face."
"Me also," he said.
He smiled and then cringed as the fire axe fell out of the roof onto the deck. She'd forgotten it and let it go.
"What mechance was that?"
Insurance, she smiled. Are you alone?
Indeed, no, Unworth said.
He gestured to the men behind him. Fiveflank emerged into the light of the bridge, followed by Onofrio, the head cook, and Santu, the tertiary helmsman.
We four are all that's left, said Unworth. Following the mutiny, all such.
Fiveflank grumbled his disgust.
Mutiny? Kiss asked.
Mutiny indeed, said Unworth. My crew was stricken by mutational urge. Just after we made arrival, just after Master Thonius took them down.
Who?
Ma'am Plighton, Masters Balak and Belknap, and himself.
Down?
In a lander, number one lander, to the surface.
What happened here, Sholto? Kiss asked.
He shrugged.
Screaming and crying, he said.
And howling, added Santu behind him.
Yes, and that. My poor ship went mad. Oh, the screaming and the howling. Oh, the upsetment. Bogwin led the mutiny.
I never liked him much,
put in Onofrio.
Me neither, said Santu.
It was Bogwin's doing, said Unworth. He was enspooked. When the howling started, he gripped the crew with all forcefulness. They had guns. They debarked on the second lander.
Thonius had already taken the first, Kiss nodded. Sholto, where did the howling come from?
Unworth shrugged.
Where is Frauke? Where is Zale?
I have no idea,
he replied, timid and worried.
Sholto, we're in trouble, said Kiss.
Fiveflank nudged Unworth. The little shipmaster ran to his command console and adjusted some dials. Several warning lights had started to flash.
What?
Asked Kiss, coming over.
Something is extruding,
Unworth said.
Extruding?
Kiss replied.
A ship,
said Unworth.
Bearing in towards us.
Kiss looked at the flaring screen. It was a mess of complex graphics with little clarity.
Are you certain? Kiss asked. It could just be an imaging artifact.
Unworth fine-tuned the scanners, and the display cleaned up. The track became very legible. Plotting data overwrote the curving trajectory marker, showing comparative speed, position, and size. The approaching ship was decelerating from an Immaterium exit point 9 astronomical units out. It seemed twice the size of the Arethusa.
Picked feed, she asked. Can we get a visual with the stern array?
He stabbed at some of the controls. On a secondary imaging plate, a ghost image appeared, a fog of green and amber pixelation. The screen image jumped and panned as the picked array grabbed focus and range. They could see it. A long way off and small, but, to patience Kiss, unmistakable.
Oh, Thrawn, Kiss gasped. That's the Hinterlight.
The Vox bank lit up behind Unworth.
Hailing signal, he said. Picked at voice in simulation.
Take it, said Kiss.
Unworth nodded to Santu, who hurried to the comm station and woke the Vox bank. The main screen blinked twice and then lit up. The distorted blinking view of a woman's face appeared, peering at them.
Hello, Arethusa? Hello, Arethusa?
The words came through a yowl of white noise. Kiss lifted the Vox mic on its heavy cable.
Hello, Hinterlight. Hello. Mistress Sinia, is that you?
The fuzzy visual frowned at them.
Confirmed. Who am I speaking to? Is that you, Kara?
More white noise squalled.
No, it's me,
Kiss called into the mic.
It's Patience.
It's Patience, the blur on the viewer said to someone off-screen. There was yet more crackle and fuzz.
Get me a clean link, Holstrom, for Throne's sake,
they heard her say. The viewer image suddenly sharpened. Kiss looked up at the unsmiling, troubled features of Sinia Priest, mistress of the Hinterlight.
This is an unexpected pleasure, said Kiss,
aware she had tears in her eyes.
I imagine you're surprised to see me, said Priest over the speakers. Believe me, you're not half as surprised as I was a week ago.
What?
Asked Kiss. The image of Priest jumped and fluttered. She glanced sidelong at someone off view and stepped back. A figure moved into her place and looked into the picture with a half smile. It was Harlan Nail. Chapter 2 There was a storm coming. Layla Slade could hear the brewing grumble of thunder rolling down from the hog's back of dark mountains above Elmingard.
The fulminous sky, an increase in negative ions, made her scratchy and irritable. It was late afternoon. She stood on the dry, bare stone of the high terrace and looked down the crag. Elmingard occupied the crown of a buttress of old black rock, which dropped away, sheer in places, about 1,000 meters to the valley below. Down there, only a few kilometers away, there was sunlight and arable land, low hills skirted by woodland, post-harvest fields full of dry straw, the rural belt of southern Saar, where the headwaters of the Pelletor sprang, about as comfortable and pastoral a tract of land as you could find on any old imperial world. Things turned darker and wilder, however, when you reached the abrupt feet of the Kell Mountains, smaller, surly, westerly cousins to the mighty Atenates that dominated the continental heartland. They rose like a mistake from the undulating countryside of Saar. Storms fretted around them all year long, as if their thorny backs snagged the passing weather and detained it until it became annoyed. Mists filled the abyssal gorges and steep ravines like uncombed wool. Often the cloud and haze descended so deeply that the entire range was lost from sight. One could stand in a cornfield 10 kilometers away and not know there were mountains there at all. It was not Layla Slade's favorite place in the galaxy. Elmingard had been built as a monastic retreat 1,700 years earlier, during a period of plague and schismatic war that had marred Gudrun's history. Subsequently, it had been derelict, and then the home of a feral astronomer. For many years after that, it had been the impractical country seat of wealthy Saurian viticulturalists who cultivated vast vineyards in the peaceful country below. They had died out and departed, defeated by the lonely eminence, and Elmingard had fallen back into disuse, scavenged by the weather. Orfeo Kalzean had purchased it through a chain of faceless middlemen 20 years before. He'd had extensive work done to restore and develop the rambling property, but Layla still had little love for the place. It had been too many things in its bleak lifetime, and the result was a schizophrenic knot of identities. It was too large, too jumbled, too muddled. The long, austere sections of monastic origin were cold and damp, sagging under patches of sloped grey tile roof that looked like snakeskin. The viticulturalist contributions consisted of dirty, white stone halls grafted in between the monastic wings, halls that interlocked oddly and had too many stories. There were stairs and abutting terraces everywhere. The astronomer, in a characteristic act of whimsy, had raised a crude tower of black stone at the north end of the crag, perhaps as an observatory platform. Its construction was not especially sound, and it had become a leaning ruin, but it had never been demolished. Kalzean believed it lent Elmingard an alchemic charm. Slade walked back along the high terrace, under the shadow of the astronomer's tower. Roosting birds clacked and cawed like lost souls. Thick beards of ivy and asterolia covered the face of the grey walls below her. Kalzean and Moloch were arguing in the solar. She could hear their voices. Another storm brewing. They had been arguing for several weeks. Kalzean described it to her as debate, but she'd seen the growing resentment in the eyes of both men. The essential nature of the debate, as far as she understood it, was to agree upon the scheme they would undertake together. There was the recurring question of Slight. Since Kalzean had first posited the notion of Moloch's relationship with Slight and Ravenna, Moloch had become increasingly obsessed and distracted. He was starting to exhibit what Slade believed was paranoia, pure and simple. He had been gravely disappointed to learn that Ravenna had bluntly rejected Kalzean's proposal, as if he had actually been expecting a positive response. He stayed up late into the night, in his room in the dormitory wing, filling up notebooks with rapid, almost feverish penmanship, consulting the library of books and manuscripts that Kalzean had imported. A vast number of books, manuscripts, and other esoteric objects filled the rooms and corridors of Elmingard, many of them still in shipping cases, waiting to be unpacked. Kalzean had sent for them when he had decided on the place as his latest bolt-hole, and they had arrived by freight shipment from storage deposits, bank vaults, and discreet caches all over the sector. Kalzean was a collector of many things, and he magpied away his lifetime's accumulation of arcane ephemera in 1,000 separate hiding places for later retrieval. Only the most valuable items came with him on his travels. Certain potent devices, his shining weapons of destiny,
certain books of special provenance, certain charts and grimoires. He always carried his small but priceless library of anthropodermic bibliopathy, the life stories of significant saints, savants, murderers and heretics bound in the skins of the men themselves, and his collection of diodans. The desperate nature of their flight from Eustace Majoris had forced him to leave his precious diodans in Petropolis, a fact that he still complained about. He had arranged for their private recovery, again through an untraceable chain of anonymous intermediaries, but the caution he had to exercise to procure them meant he probably wouldn't be reunited with the collection for several years. Slade walked to the solar and peered in through the half-open door. Moloch and Kalzean were conversing with some vehemence. For the third day running, the talk had turned to the feasibility of constructing new Gnosis engines for a return to Sleaf. When Slade had first heard them mentioned, she had questioned Kalzean about them privately.
"Sleaf outworld lay," he had said. "Dirty little mudball, far away from all things good, out in the skirts of Calyxis sector."
"Have you been there?"
"No," he said. "But I've studied various reports. Moloch has been there. It was where Ravenna killed him the first time."
Layla Slade had looked at Kalzean, puzzled. Kalzean had snorted, as if he'd made a fabulous joke.
"I don't understand. What's so wonderful about this place?"
"There are vents there, Layla. Volcanic vents. They have a special quality. The skin of reality is thin there, Layla. One can hear the vibration of the immaterium, just out of reach. The vents speak."
"They speak, do they?"
"They do. Voices from the warp, mumbling fragments from the demonverse. With the correct equipment, in this case a very curious and expensive device called a Gnosis engine, the voices can be collected and stored."
"For analysis?"
"Yes, and as a source of infernal power."
Kalzean had then rambled on at length, his terminology becoming more and more technical and arcane, until Layla was lost. She knew he knew she hadn't the slightest hope of understanding the workings of the Gnosis engine, but he insisted on explaining it. He had even drawn a little sketch for her. Then he had told her about Ravenna. Moloch had been on Sleaf Outworld with several Gnosis engines built by the Cognitae, and the Inquisition had arrived to destroy the project. Moloch and Ravenna had battled. They hadn't even known who each other was, and Moloch had escaped with his life. Just. He had jumped, or fallen, into a vent. A teleport had saved him, but not before he had been caught in an upblast of venting fire. He had been scorched by demonic energy, injuries that took him a long time to recover from. Kalzean told her he believed that was the moment when Ravenna and Moloch had their destinies linked and placed in the hands of the ruinous powers. Through the vents, the warp had scented them, tasted them, acquired them. The ruinous powers had enigmatic plans, plans too long, too involved, and too abstruse for any mortal mind to comprehend. But the powers could see that before their brief lives ended, Ravenna and Moloch would perform a great service for them.
"And this service is slight," she had replied.
"This service is slight, yes," he had replied.
Layla stepped back from the solar door. From what she could hear, Moloch and her master had managed to disagree on the precise configuration of a Gnosis engine and what alloy best served as an inner lining. There was talk of engaging private fabricators, possibly from Caxton or Sarum, at great expense, and a discussion of how the engine would be shipped. The only thing they seemed to agree on was that the vents of Sleaf Outworld might be a conduit through which they could learn pertinent and valuable information about the mysterious slight. Her ear tag pinged, and she left the solar, coming out of the building across a small, walled courtyard, before running up the steps into the central block of the house sprawl. Thunder grumbled in the sky behind her, and a breeze had picked up, nodding the tight buds of the arid roses that grew in the courtyard. The sky itself, bright yellow in the east, had bruised black with a thunderhead in the west, as if night and day were coexisting in the same sky. She reached the security control center. Like many rooms in Elmingard, its crumbling exterior of flaked plaster and patchy stone belied an extensive modern interior. The walls had been paneled with brushed steel plates, and a grilled deck allowed an underfloor gap for power cables and data trunking. There were six cogitator desks, arranged in a star pattern, all facing into the center. The machines clacked and hummed, their valve tubes glowing, and their imaging plates rippling with green sine waves.
In the center of the circle, in the heart of the star, was a large 360-degree hololithic display. Each cogitator desk had a vox assembly bolted onto it, linked under the floor to a bulky, high-gain voxcaster in the corner of the room. Extractor fans in the ceiling kept the accumulation of machine heat in the room to a minimum. Druet and Zabo, two members of Kulzean's hired, immaculately vetted staff, were on duty. They wore plain suits of navy blue wool with neat silver buttons.
"Yes?" she asked.
"Incoming transport, ma'am," said Druet.
"Origin?"
"The landing fields at Dorset. It's broadcasting the correct code fields."
"How far out is it?" Slade asked.
6 minutes, ma'am," said Zabo.
"Ask for the final handshake code and direct it to the landing. I'll be there to meet it."
The two men nodded and turned back to their cogitators. Layla Slade hurried out of the security room, back out across the courtyard, and began to descend through the rambling labyrinth of Elmingard via terraces, stone staircases, and twisting steps. As she strode along, she opened her link.
"This is Slade. I want 3 guns to meet me on the landing immediately."
"Yes, ma'am."
She adjusted her link setting and made another connection.
"Layla."
"Sorry to disturb you, sir. There's a transport approaching."
"Any surprises?"
"I'm making sure there isn't."
She had reached the southern end of the mountain fastness. Beyond the line of the old monastic wall, a large part of the clifftop had been cleared back to form a natural landing pad of granite. She stood facing the landing, looking out at the evening sunlight over Saar. The monastic wall and the shadow of Elmingard rose behind her, and then the wilder shadows of the mountains. She felt the first few spots of rain in the air. Thunder growled. 3 men in light body armor appeared through the wall gate behind her. They carried las carbines.
"Just a precaution," she told them.
She spoke into her link again.
"Security control. Arm the wall sentry guns, please. Voice command to me."
"Yes, ma'am,"
the link crackled back. Slade heard the sentry pods go live over the gusting breeze, an arm with a clatter of autoloaders. They could see the transport, a light lander, a gig, its running lights bright white like stars in the fading sky as it came head-on towards them. Slade slid out her auto pistol, popped the standard clip, and switched it for one she carried in her belt pouch, one of Kulzean's special loads. She slammed it home, but she didn't rack it. You didn't walk around with something like that in the spout. The lander swept in, big and dark in the threatening sky, its winglets hooked like the pinions of a stooping hawk. Its nose light was blinking. Its landing claws descended from their hatches with whines audible over the thruster downwash. The wind picked up on the landing, and the downdraft lashed grit up in a wide spiral. The lander touched down with a final howl of thrusters, its claw struts bending to take its weight. The thruster wash immediately dropped, though the belly lights kept flashing, lighting the rock shelf amber. Slade could see the pilot servitor through the cockpit windows, shutting down systems in the green glow of his instrumentation. The side hatch opened like petals. A tall, red-haired man in a glass jacket came down the ramp and walked briskly over to Layla. He was followed more lethargically by the pearl-armored bulk of Lucius Vorner.
"Stand down. Deactivate systems," Layla Slade said into her link.
"Yes, ma'am."
"Master Siskind," she said.
"My dear Layla,"
the red-haired man replied with a smile. He leaned in and kissed her on each cheek.
"You're looking as radiant as ever."
Slade couldn't abide Siskind's familiarity, but she tolerated it. "You didn't shoot the shipmaster your employer was retaining."
"A good trip?"
she asked. He nodded.
"A bumpy ride in places. Yutokri turned into something of a fracas. But all's done. We made high anchor this morning."
Vorner joined them.
"Slade,"
he growled.
"Lucius?"
She changed out the special load from her weapon, replaced it with the standard clip, and put the gun away.
"Fracas is probably not a word you should use in your report to Orfeo,"
she said to Siskind.
"Not if you're trying to ingratiate yourself."
"Oh, I don't know,"
a voice said from behind them.
"I enjoy a good fracas once in a while."
Kulzean had joined them on the landing. He was wearing a richly embroidered gown of Hesperian silk over a simple black body glove. He looked like the hereditary ruler of some ancient mountain satrapy.
"Sir?"
said Siskind with a smile, shaking his hand. Vorner nodded respectfully.
"So?"
Kulzean asked with a cunning smirk.
"Fracas, wasn't it?" It all went to hell,
Vorna told him in his deep, bass voice, like a testament of doom.
I lost some men. The witch house got scragged. You didn't come out unscathed yourself, I see,
said Kalzean, nodding at the raw, healing wheals on Vorna's moonscape face.
It'll heal,
the bounty hunter replied.
But the trap worked, Kalzean asked. Tell me it worked, after all the trouble we went to.
It worked, said Siskind. Ravenna is very, very dead.
End of story, said Vorna.
A smile spread across Kalzean's face. He checked it.
We're sure about that.
Oh, yes, said Siskind.
He gestured back at the lander. We had it confirmed by a very reliable source. Siskind's first officer, Ornales, appeared from the lander. He was escorting someone at gunpoint. Her hands were bound, and she had obviously suffered extensively. She was limping, and her face was bruised.
Her name is Kara Swole, said Siskind. Until we got our hands on her, she was one of Ravenna's principal agents.
Really?
Asked Kalzean. His eyes brightened.
Of course. Moloch has mentioned her name. How did you come by her?
She penetrated the allure while we were still at anchor over Utokri, said Siskind. She was attempting to discover where we were bound, so that the remnants of Ravenna's team could pursue us in some pathetic attempt at vengeance. However, Lucius and I apprehended her before she could gain access to anything valuable.
This is what she claims.
That is the truth of it, said Siskind. I have been, how can I put this delicately, I have been questioning her for several days. My methods are reliable. This is the truth. Ravenna died in the witch house, and the remains of his band are leaderless, divided, and lost. I was going to kill her, but I had a feeling both you and Moloch would chastise me for robbing you of a diversion.
You thought wisely, Master Siskind, said Kalzean. There'll be a bonus in this for you. Leigh, let's get the cook to produce something special tonight. A welcoming feast, and a celebratory one. Have the lovely Mam Swole secured in the alcove.
Slade nodded.
This way, she said.
Dead-eyed, the prisoner limped in the direction indicated. Layla Slade almost felt sorry for her. No one deserved to be left in Siskin's care for days on end. Chapter 3
Come with me,
said Harlan Nail, the moment Patience stepped through the Hinterlight's air gate. He hugged her tight.
Come with me.
There's too much to...
Just come with me.
Nail nodded to Unworth and the other three crewmen, who had come across from the Arethusa in the Hinterlight's launch. At Kiss's insistence, no one remained behind on the haunted derelict. Elman Hallstrom, priest's solid, dependable first officer, a navy vet, had come to meet them at the airgate with Nail. Gentlemen, he said. Master Unworth, allow me to welcome you to the Hinterlight. Perhaps you'd care for some refreshment. Nail led Kiss away down the Hinterlight's long access tunnels. The smell, the quality of the lamplight, the stylistic details. It felt almost unbearably familiar to Kiss.
I thought you were dead, she whispered.
I thought I was dead, he agreed.
Why aren't you dead? Where did you go?
Those are two questions I find it almost impossible to answer, Patience, he replied,
hustling her along.
We went through the door. It was the only escape.
To where?
Places you wouldn't believe.
Why not?
Because I was there, and I don't friggin' believe him, he replied.
But,
she began.
We'll get to the but, and the why, and the what, later, he said.
He led her into the Hinterlight's well-equipped infirmary. The ship's medique, Zargeran, nodded to her. Kiss came to a slow halt. She stared. A vague shape, amorphous, hung suspended in a stasis tube, veiled in a sheen of blue light. The tube apparatus was connected to a wealth of humming, pinging, gurgling mechanical equipment. It looked as if most of the infirmary's battery of devices had been hooked up to it.
Oh, Throne, she whispered.
He's resting, said Nail. He's going to need a long, slow recovery time.
He was in a very poor state when I got to him, said the medique softly,
inspecting a few console readouts.
Massive stab trauma, organ failure, necrotization, exhaustion, secondary and tertiary infections. He'd been out of support for some time while he received emergency surgery.
Very rudimentary surgery, in my opinion.
She did her best, Nail said.
Zardaran shrugged. He arrested all vitals at least 3 times under her knife, but yes, I think she did. Kiss stepped forward. She felt numb. She couldn't really see what was in the tube. It was just a dark blur, but she could feel what was in it. She reached out her hand and touched the glass.
Gideon?
Patience.
The send was distant, like a whisper. Tears sprang up in her eyes.
I'm so sorry, Gideon. I'm so sorry. I should not have left you. I should never have...
Shh,
the whisper sent back. Zardaran insisted they leave Ravenna to rest. Nail took Kiss up to the Hinterlight's ready room. It was a sumptuous private lounge, as befitted the mistress's character. Shipmistress Sinia Priest was already there, with Hullstrom, entertaining Unworth and his 3 crewmen. Sinia Priest was more than 280 years old, although she always claimed, not unconvincingly, a much lower figure. She had a womanly, matronly frame, cropped blonde hair, and a penchant for heavy eye makeup, and ostentatiously dangly earrings. She was wearing a fine tailored satin suit and red velvet robes. An irascible, strong-minded woman, Priest was nevertheless intensely loyal, although her relationship with Ravenna and her role as a hired servant of the Ordos had become increasingly strained since the incident at Majescus. After Bonner's Reach, when the Hinterlight had been forced to limp away for repairs a second time, they had parted company, partly through necessity. Ravenna had needed to return to Eustace Majoris urgently, and, for that reason, the Arethusa was hired. Kiss had been privately sure that Priest was glad to see the back of them. The shipmistress showed no sign of that now. She rose as Nail brought Kiss into the ready room and gave her a maternal hug.
"How are you, my dear?"
she asked, as if she really cared.
"Happier than I was. You'll have to excuse me. I haven't washed or changed my clothes in a fortnight."
"There will be time for that later," said Priest. "Have some Amasek to steady yourself. Hallstrom, some Amasek?"
Hallstrom rose to pour the drink. Kiss looked around. The entire situation had a dislocated, dreamy quality. Apart from Priest, Hallstrom, and Unworth's band, she saw Angharad seated in a corner. The Carthayan was dressed a plain brown gown. Her intricate leather body armor was laid out like a shed skin across her lap, and she was diligently repairing it with wire thread, a steel needle, and a pair of cutters. She didn't spare Kiss a second glance. A young girl sat near to her, prepubescent, wide-eyed and strange. She was playing with a key and laughing to herself. Hallstrom brought Kiss her Amasek.
"It's good to see you," he said,
and gave her a peck on the cheek as he handed her the drink. She smiled. She had always been fond of the first officer. He was always reassuring, like the father she had never known.
"Tell me what happened," she said,
sitting down with Nail. The others looked on. Nail told her, as best he could. His explanation lasted a long time and rambled more than once as details failed to make sense until he backed up and explained them. The workings of the door sounded impossible and insane to Kiss's ears, and she asked a lot of questions. Angharad, working and not looking up, interjected several times to correct Nail's facts.
"Finally, we ended up in this place, Rajez," said Nail at length. Priest had just given him a second Amasek. "We were a long way out by then. The Ultima Segmentum, 1,000 years out.
"A 1,000? Kiss breathed. "Back or?"
"Back," said Nail.
"1,000 long years, 1,000 long years,
the child Ayasob sang, playing with her key. Everyone looked at her. She didn't notice.
"Gideon was in a bad way by then," Nail continued, "close to death. He tried to hide it, but I knew. He'd worked out how to steer us through the door by using his mind, but his mind wasn't strong enough anymore. The door was playing games, I think, being deliberately willful. He'd asked it for the Arethusa in 404, and that's where it took us. Listening station, Arethusa, in 404.M40.
Kiss shook her head.
"Bellon?"
"We were locked up, as suspected enemy agents. Ravenna's rosette was no use. No one could confirm we were who we said we were, but I convinced them to help Ravenna. There was a Medicae, Bashisvili. We owe her a lot."
"And?"
I think Ravener managed to form some kind of bond with her while she was working on him. He got into her mind and showed her the truth. He persuaded her how important it was for us to get out. He died, technically speaking, several times on her table. Once she had resuscitated him and got him stable, she was able to show a partial monitor record of one of his deaths to the station commander. With her key prisoner dead, the commander turned her attention to other priorities. They were expecting a raid.
A raid?
There was a war going on. Anyway, it bought Bashisvili enough breathing space to fix up and clean up the chair, get Ravener back into it, and spring us. By the time the station commander noticed her other prisoners were gone, Bashisvili had got us out of the compound and into the thorns.
Kiss held up a hand.
Well, the thorns?
Ah, sorry, said Nail. I missed a bit. The Raja's station was surrounded by psi-active thorn growth. Kaikid, they called it.
Kukud, said Angharad from the back of the room. Get it right, man.
Kukud. That was the key, you see. That was what Ravener had realized.
I don't see, said Kiss.
His mind was too weak by then to operate the door properly, said Nao. But the psi-active weed gave him a boost, an amplifier. He willed us home, and a thorn scrub magnified the thought. He wanted to go back to his ship.
And this Bashisvili woman?
Nail sighed.
She had as much desire to be displaced 1,000 years out of time as we did. She stayed.
He paused.
So we opened the door.
I opened the door, said Ayasob with a giggle, holding up the key. That is my function.
That's right, said Nail. Ayasob very cleverly opened the door, and we stepped through. And we weren't on the Arethusa at all.
They gave me a bloody scare, I can tell you, said Priest. You were on the Hinterlight, asked Kiss. In dry dock anchor at the Navy Yards at Lenk, said Priest. This bloomin' door had taken your lord and master literally again. It had brought him to his ship, all right.
How long ago?
2 weeks ago, said Nail.
I'll tell her this bit, Priest cut in. I was walking the rounds one afternoon. We'd just signed off repairs the month before with the Navy architects. I was considering my options, developing plans to open a trade line down to Caxton, small perishables and quality goods, you know the sort of thing. My dear Patience, the last thing I intended was to get entangled with the Inquisition again.
They'd given us some bother, said Hallstrom. He looked at Kiss. We'd been inspected and interviewed by Ordo agents 3 times. They were aware of our links to your master.
The last time was by some highfalutin bitch called... What was it, Hallstrom?
Inquisitor Lilith, said Hallstrom.
That's the bitch, said Priest, clapping her hands.
That's the bitch, that's the bitch,
Ayasob sang out, not looking at them.
Play with your lovely key, dear,
Priest told her.
This Lilith, she turned up just a few days before this door did. I became very aware that Gideon was a wanted man. I wondered what the bloody hell he'd been up to. Anyway, I told her we hadn't seen him in months. She searched my darling ship and buggered off. So, I was walking the rounds, as I say, and was just going through the Enginarium. I'd given the crew some shore leave, a last hurrah before we disembarked, and there shouldn't have been anyone around. Then this bloody voice says out of nowhere,
"Hello, Sinia," said Nail.
"I nearly wet myself," said Sinia Priest. I turned around, and there was your man Harlan, the little girl, the big lass with the sword, and Gideon in his chair, gasping his last. More importantly, there was a brand new wooden door opening out from the left ventricle of the drive assembly.
"He'd got you home," said Kiss to Nail. She sighed. "You know, Kara never doubted him. Kara said he'd beat the odds, even certain death. I didn't believe her. I should have."
Nail shook his head. "In your place, I wouldn't have. We played the longest shot possible. The odds stacked up against us. We went the long way round. I'm still amazed we made it."
"Is the door still there?" asked Kiss.
Hallstrom nodded his head. "We check on it regularly. Its presence in engineering, the impossibility of it, troubles the crew. If it doesn't disappear in due course, I don't know what we'll do about it." Kiss rose to her feet. She swayed slightly.
"I'm sorry," she told them. "That Amasek's gone straight to my head. I haven't eaten much. What I want to know is, after all of that,
How in Throne's name did you end up here?
Hedgerow birds, pollen, and the local constellations.
Gideon?
She asked. They could all hear him. Ayasob stopped playing, and Angharad looked up sullenly. I'm sorry for eavesdropping, and I know I should be resting, but I've come too far to stop now.
Birds?
Asked Kiss. Through the door, I met Orfeo Calzean. Remember him? We had a conversation.
What kind of conversation? Asked Kiss.
It doesn't matter. We were in a field. I had no idea where, and he wasn't going to tell me. But I knew it was wherever he and Moloch had gone to ground. A planet somewhere. An affordable jump distance of Utokri. No more than a subsector or two away at most. There were birds, local flora, evening stars. Once I got here, and the excellent Medicae Sargeran made me comfortable, I started to go back through the records I'd made, comparing them to the Hinterlite's extensive database. The asset of having a support chair with perfect recording systems is that you can store things in the most extreme detail, more extreme than a regular mind could remember. I compared star patterns, the cellular detail of crop husks, the patterning of small birds. It took a while, but ultimately, there was no doubt at all.
Gudrun, said Kiss. We set off immediately, said Priest. I could tell Gideon was in no mood to tarry. Oh, Throne, you pinpointed Gudrun by some birds and corn husks, asked Kiss.
Every planet has its own specific and quite characteristic microculture. And actually, I didn't pinpoint Gudrun.
What then?
I pinpointed the Upper Zar provincial zone of Gudrun, within 20 kilometers of the Kel Massif. Kiss started to laugh. I knew you'd like that, said Nail, grinning. Now it's your turn. What happened to you?
Kiss looked at her empty glass, and Holstrom refilled it. Then she told them everything that had happened since they had broken free of the dying witch house.
Any response from Karl or Balak?
Nothing, said Nail grimly.
Not even a hint. Ravenna's repaired Voxbonder had a slightly lower, droning quality. They were still getting used to it.
Wherever they are, they're not answering, Nail said.
We must tread carefully with Balak, said Ravenna. I'm not sure what he is yet, but he's hiding something.
Interrogator Balak is beyond reproach, Angharad snapped from the back of the launch's cabin.
No, he's not, said Ravenna. When I was wearing him, I found a black dam block.
Yes, you do like to wear people, don't you? Sneered Angharad. Against their will.
Shut up, said Kiss.
She had showered for a long time, and was wearing clean clothes, Hinterlite crew fatigues that didn't quite fit. She felt ungainly and unfeminine. She imagined that was how Maud Plighton felt much of the time. The thought of Maud made her tense.
Are you sure you're up to this? She asked.
He shouldn't be doing it at all, said Nail.
Well, I am, Ravenna replied. From what you've told me, I haven't got time to sit around and heal.
Mr. Holstrom, 2 minutes to dock. Holstrom called from the launch's helm position. He had insisted on piloting them.
Thank you.
Nail, Kiss, and a nervous-looking Unworth sat in the cabin behind him. Ravenna's chair, repaired but still showing the marks of its damage, sat in the cargo space behind them. Angharad reclined in one of the rear seats. She was wearing her restitched armor, and Ayasob had patiently rebraided her hair. None of them had any idea what they should do with the child housekeeper. A Viscerex lay in its scabbard across Angharad's long legs.
A black dam? Asked Kiss. That's a cognite technique.
It is, said Ravenna. Our friend Balak was concealing something, something big. It is possible he is the one hiding slight.
Nonsense, Angharad spat.
I tend to agree with obnoxious sword girl, said Kiss. It's Zael, I have no doubt. He's got to Frauke somehow, turned him. I know what went on aboard the Arethusa.
I saw it, in all fair point, said Unworth. Psychic chaos, the breadth of the warp released. If it wasn't a demon, I don't know what.
We'll see, said Ravenna. Holstrom guided the launch expertly into the Arethusa's docking bay. Automatic systems clamped them in place and folded the hull doors, equalizing pressure.
We're good, said Hallstrom, taking off his headset, unbuckling his harness, and turning to look back at them. "Mr. Hallstrom, please stay here. Stand by to leave at a moment's notice."
"Understood, sir," said Hallstrom.
The others unbuckled their restraints and rose. They clambered down out of the launch's aft hatch into the echoing docking bay. Nail held a shotgun. Unworth fumbled with a las pistol the priest had lent him.
"You may stay with the launch if you like, Master Unworth," said Ravener as he floated down the ramp.
"Thank you. I will oblige you, however,"
said Unworth.
"I want my ship back."
They advanced towards the access way. The air, oddly fresh, smelled of cinnamon or fresh-cut grass.
"Do you feel anything?" asked Kiss. "I couldn't lock him down, but I was too afraid to try. You're much stronger than me."
"Not today," said Ravener. "I may have to rely on all of you. In answer to your question, Patience, not yet. I can feel something. I can hear..."
"What?"
asked Kiss.
"Sobbing. You hear that?"
They turned down one of the Arethusa's empty spinal corridors. The deck lights were still guttering. Angharad pulled out her sword in a fluid movement.
"Eviscerex thirsts," she said.
"I'm sure it does," said Ravener. "I've got something. Something very clear. It feels like... Whiston."
"How can you feel him?" asked Nail. "He's a blunter."
"He's compromised," said Kiss. "I said he was."
"It's Whiston," said Ravener. "Or, at least, it's something that wants us to feel it's Whiston."
Kiss shuddered. Unworth looked up at her and calmly held her hand. She looked down at him, saw his nervous smile, and squeezed his hand.
"How close?" asked Nail. "Very close," Ravener replied. "The forward hold."
They approached the hold hatch. Unworth let Kiss's hand go and scurried forwards to key in a code. The hatch groaned. Tutting, Angharad strode up, put her shoulder to the hatch, and slid it slowly open with a grunt.
"Gotta love her," said Nail.
Kiss snorted. They entered the forward hold. It was empty, derelict. Packing cartons, pulped and shredded, littered the floor space.
"I hear sobbing," said Kiss.
They looked up. Whiston Frauke sat on one of the iron crossbeams high up in the hold's roof. How he'd got up there, none of them would ever know. He was sobbing, every breath jagging out of him like a gasp. His upper lip, mouth and chin were wet with blood. It was dripping out of his nose.
"I tried," he murmured. "I tried. Protect him, you said. And I tried," he coughed,
and blood sprayed from his mouth. Zale hung in his arms like a stringless puppet.
"Whiston."
"Yes, Gideon."
"Glory. You can hear me?"
"Yes, Gideon. That's really frigged up, isn't it? I mean, I'm an untouchable, right?"
"Not anymore," said Ravener.
Frauke sobbed some more. Blood dripped down onto the deck beside them.
"Is he awake?"
"What?" asked Frauke.
"Is Zale awake?"
"No. Yes, in his head he is. He has been for a long time."
"I told them. I told them," Kiss exclaimed.
"Sorry about that, Patience, but if he'd known, he would have killed him."
"Who?"
"Slight, of course."
"Whiston."
"I had to hide for so long, Chair," said Frauke, hugging the limp body to his chest with both arms. "For so long. He was here all the time, and I didn't dare look out. He'd have seen me. He'd have killed me as if I was nothing."
"It's all right."
"It's not all right," Frauke barked. "I was scared. I was tired of hiding, but he was there all the time. Right there. You couldn't hear me, Chair, or you didn't want to."
"I always wanted to,"
said Frauke.
"Well, I woke up once he'd left the ship. When it was safe. I think I scared the crew a bit. I'm sorry I scared them."
"What the frig is Frauke babbling about?"
Nail asked.
"It's not Frauke," said Ravener. "It's Zale. He's channeling Zale."
Nail looked up at the figures perched in the rafters.
"Zale?"
Patience stepped forward.
"Zale, hello? I need to know something."
"Hello, Patience. You're pretty," said Frauke, mindlessly.
"Thank you, Zale. If you're not Slight, who is?"
"Balak," said
said Ravenna, emphatically. "Balak's nothing," said Frauke's mouth. "Slight's been with us from the start."
"Zael?"
"Thonius Slight. Thonius Slight. Thonius Slight," Frauke cackled. Incremental terror filled Nail, Kiss, and Ravenna simultaneously. Disbelief. Horror.
"Watch above!"
Unworth yelled out. Frauke had slumped forwards, letting Zael's body go. Both of them dropped like stones from the crossbeam and plunged towards the hold deck.
"Kiss."
"I've got them," she said.
Chapter 4 Carl Thonius climbed down out of the cargo 8 they had leased at Dorsay. His boots kicked dust up off the rural track. Behind him, Plighton, Balak, and Belknap got out of the vehicle. They had parked under a stand of trees on a lonely country road. Evening was closing in across the fields. Ahead of them, 2 kilometers away, the sudden grim bulwarks of the Kell Mountains rose like a threat. They were sheathed in mist and storm cover, almost invisible. The country around was still and quiet. There was a soft breeze and the even song of birds heading to roost in the woods. But there was a persistent ringing, buzzing sound in Carl Thonius's head, like tinnitus. Carl started to breathe deeply, checking the rings on his fingers. 1, 2, 3.
"Up there. Is that the place?" asked Belknap,
shouldering the worn X-Guard issue LAS rifle he had brought. Plighton nodded.
"I'm sure. The lander left the Allure in parking orbit and dropped at Dorsay Field. Then it came out here."
"You're sure?" Belknap asked her, dubiously.
"Magistratum skills, Belknap. Trust me," she said. "I know how to ask around on the sly and how to track a suspect vehicle. It came here. The flight path was keyed and logged at the field office."
"I don't think they know we're here," said Thonius. "If they suspected we were right behind them, we'd know it."
He stared up at the almost invisible summit above them.
"I'm going to kill Zygmunt Moloch,"
he said in a whisper none of the others heard. Belknap had crossed to the far side of the track and was playing his electro-binoculars at the crags ahead. The lenses whirred and clicked. None of them had wanted him to come along. They all considered him a non-combatant. But he had insisted, for Kara's sake, while there was still a hope. None of them could argue with that.
"Big place up there," Belknap said, squinting through his field glasses. "Like a palace. We'll have to get closer for me to make anything definite."
"Then let's get closer," said Thonius.
"I still can't raise the Arethusa," said Balak, shaking his Voxlink. "What the hell's up with that?"
"Atmospherics," said Thonius. "There's a storm coming in down the mountains."
"I couldn't raise them in Dorsay either," said Balak.
"Atmospherics," Thonius repeated. "They're all right, sitting pretty. What's important is down here. Let's spread out and scope the area."
They fanned out. Plighton and Belknap followed the track down to fields. Balak and Thonius followed parallel paths into the creaking woods. They could feel the pressure of the gathering storm. The boughs sighed and groaned as the wind stirred them. Leaves fluttered. The rot-dry husks of wind-felled trees attested to the power that local storms could develop. Carl Thonius came to a halt in a sighing glade. The others were out of sight. He could see the mountains a little better through the swaying branches ahead of him than from the road. They were a black shape smeared in cloud. Behind them, the sky was clean and ochre, stippled with stars. The buzzing had grown worse. Thonius realized his right hand was shaking. He forced it to be still. He had come to regret many things in these last days of his human life, and the strangest regret of all was that he hadn't left his right arm in the cattle pen on Flint. He had been trying so hard for such a long time, but he knew it was beating him. It was just a matter of time. The dark energy within him was like a grotesque pressure. He felt like an overboiled kettle rattling on a stove burner. At any moment, he could burst. He'd come close to bursting too many times. At Berinth, when he killed the man. Then again, by necessity, when they were trapped on the wrong side of the door and facing the hooked monsters. Letting slip his power had been the only thing that had saved them. At that moment, he'd been just a sliver of willpower away from letting go altogether. Such a terrible glee had filled him, and thrown, such temptation, to just give in,
to let himself go to the turmoil inside his soul. It would be so nice to let it stop, to cave in and surrender, and not have to fight any more. The buzzing would stop, the whispers, the pain. Two simple thoughts kept him focused. One was that he was an imperial interrogator. He had fought for that post, worked hard for it. The Carlthonius part of him wanted to serve, wanted to prove himself true. How odd, he considered, that a man inhabited by a demon might remain so devoted, give or take the odd little slip. Thonius had a dream, an ambition. He believed he had a power inside him that the whole Imperium could benefit from, but if he showed it to his masters before he could control it, they would execute him. They would exterminate him without hesitation. The buzzing in his head chuckled mockingly every time he dwelt on that ambition. He could hear it again. The other simple thought was that he didn't want to die. Not again, not like before, on Eustace Majoris. He really didn't. However much giving in might appeal, he did not want to die. There was only one more option left open to him. It was up there, in the sulking mountains, Throne willing. Moloch. If Ravenna couldn't help him nurse and control the entity lodging inside him, then the arch-heretic would find a way. Moloch had skills and knowledge, and Moloch was not bound by the moral constraints and edicts of the Ordos. He would face Moloch and force him to give up his secrets. Then he would kill him in an action of sweet vengeance for his beloved master. And then, Thonius convulsed. He dropped to his knees. The psychic force of his seizure rocked the trees around him. Loose leaves swirled and fluttered. "What the hell was that?" Belknap asked over the link. "Did anyone else feel that?"
"Carl,"
Balak called out through the woods. Thonius threw up weakly, his last meal splattering across the track as oily liquid. Syncope overtook him, and he fell on his side. His vision went. He could hear voices and buzzing.
"Carl, are you all right?"
Plighton's voice echoed from far away.
"Eat her. Eat her now. Eat her up. She's so plump and delicious. Let go and let me go, Carl. I want to be out. I want to be out."
"No,"
he moaned. He had never felt so lost. His heart was empty. His soul was sloshing full of black poison. His body ached. His right hand twitched. A ring broke and pinged off. "Fight it. Fight it.
Carl!"
His vision slowly returned. Thonius sat up, bilious and swimming.
"I'm all right, Maud," he said into his link hoarsely. "Just a bad case of ague. It'll pass."
"Leave me alone, Slight. Leave me alone. I won't let you out. Not again. I won't. I will beat you."
He heard mocking laughter, thready and thin, at the back of his mind.
"I will beat you. Moloch will know how."
He heard footsteps coming closer. They sounded like padding footsteps of the fiend itself.
"Throne, Carl, were you sick? Are you all right?"
It was Balak.
"I'm fine," said Carl Thonius, rising and wiping his mouth. "Ague. I always suffer from the ague."
Balak placed a comforting arm around Carl's shoulders and wiped Carl's chin with his handkerchief.
"You'll be all right, my friend. Dry food and boiled water. That's the best remedy for ague."
"The things you know," said Thonius.
They trudged up through the farmland towards the Kells. Light was fading fast, and a storm boomed out over the crags ahead of them. Balak tried the link one last time.
"Absolutely nothing from the Arethusa," he grumbled.
Now they were closer. Belknap fixed the crag with his electro-binoculars.
1,000-meter cliff. There's definitely some kind of building at the top. A real sprawl."
"How does anyone get up there?" asked Plighton.
"They land by flyer," said Belknap, lenses whirring. "I see a flyer parked on the lip of the cliff. They've chained it down to weather out the storm. Oh, yeah, I can see a winch, too, on the east side of the promontory. Heavy duty. A big chain cage they can crank to bring up foot traffic from the fields. It's on the left side of the cliff, see?" He passed the field glasses to Plighton.
"Like a hoist?" she asked.
"Yeah."
"I've done enough hoists for this life," she replied.
We climb, said Thonius.
Up that? Blyton laughed. Yes, said Thonius. We're rushing this, said Blyton. We have no idea what's up there. We should surveil it properly. Maybe get up in the crags to the west there. She pointed. I don't like the idea of just charging in. We need to bed down and watch the place. Measure what we're up against.
I agree, said Balak. A few days, and once we're sure...
I don't have a few days, said Thonius.
What?
Asked Balak, brushing back strands of long white hair that the wind had blown across his face. Thonius realized what he had said.
We don't have a few days, said Thonius.
No, we don't, said Belknap. He put his field glasses back in their worn case. If Kara's alive... Hell with Kara, snapped Balak. This is too important to...
Belknap held his rifle out to Plyton.
Hold this, Maud.
Why?
Because I'll shoot him otherwise.
She took the gun. Belknap moved with breathtaking speed. His fist smashed into Balak's mouth.
I'll tell you what's important, you bastard, Belknap said, glaring down at the prone interrogator. Kara! 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 Stay here if you like. I'm going up there. Madman,
Balak coughed, spitting out blood.
That's enough, snapped Thonius.
Quietly, he was impressed by Belknap's reactions. Quite apart from his speed and power, it was easy to forget that the doctor was a veteran soldier first and a medicae second. Belknap had acted out of loyalty, love, and friendship. Those were the only things that mattered anymore. Belknap was on his side.
Let's not fight amongst ourselves, Thonius said.
He held out his right hand to haul Balak up, and then, at the last moment, proffered his left hand instead.
Come on.
I'm sorry, Doctor, Balak said as he was helped up. I spoke without thinking. Of course, Kara is a priority.
Belknap grunted and took his weapon back from Plyton.
We go up, said Thonius. I know a few days' surveillance would prepare us better, Maud, but we can't afford it. Kara, bless her soul, can't afford it. If she's alive.
She's alive, said Belknap grimly.
Plyton touched his arm reassuringly.
We can't do this by the book, said Thonius. We can't even call for backup, so we go in tonight.
Belknap nodded. Plyton sighed.
Say we do,
said Balak, fingering his split lip ruefully.
How? That's 1,000 meters sheer.
We climb, said Thonius.
Again,
snorted Plyton.
Up that.
There are several routes, said Thonius. Cliff pathways. I can...
You can what?
Asked Balak.
I can see them,
Thonius replied, pointing.
There, there, and there.
Belknap took out his binoculars again and adjusted them.
Yeah, he's right. Well spotted, Carl.
How the hell did you see them? Thonius shrugged.
Pathways?
Asked Plyton.
There are at least 3 routes up the cliff, east and west, replied Belknap.
They're treacherous and steep, but they're a way in. If we survive the climb and the storm that's about to break over us...
Big if,
shuddered Plyton. Belknap looked over at Thonius.
What's the plan?
We go up, we get in. We, I don't know, kill things, said Thonius. Let's get up there first.
I think we should,
Balak began. The other 3 were already marching off down the field through the enclosing dusk.
All right, Balak said. We're going, I get that. Wait for me.
Chapter 5 Orfeo Kulzean opened the door to the alcove. The sounds of a party rang in after him from a terrace high above.
They're having fun, said Kara Swole.
They are, aren't they? Kulzean agreed.
Now you come for me, she said. More fun?
He closed the heavy black door of the room behind him and shut the sounds out.
Oh, don't be like that. It doesn't have to be like that.
You intend to torture me, said Kara.
She was shackled, painfully tight, to a wooden chair. It was the very same chair Kulzean had sat on during his conversation with Ravenna in the cornfield.
Torture is too strong a term, said Kulzean.
The alcove was a dark, dank space in the lower reaches of Elmingard, more a cell than anything. Kulzean believed it had been used by the monks ages past when they withdrew to meditate. Experimental seances also suggested that this was the place where the astronomer's servants had locked him on the days when his madness ran particularly wild. Kulzean had made it his own, a private sanctum. Not even Modoch was allowed in here. Age brown specimen skeletons hung from racks, their connective tissues replaced by intricate brass hinges and pins, every bone numbered and serialed in ink. All of the specimens belonged to freaks of nature. A giant, two encephalitic dwarves, conjoined twins, a canine with a human skull, and other things too misshapen to identify. They were just fused masses of bone and calcification. Fat glass jars sat on shelves full of diseased viscera, tumors, xenotype organs, and pickled animals, blanched white like albinos in the preserving fluids. Calzean walked over to a chest of drawers and began rifling through the contents. Kara stared at her captor.
Let me tell you, Orfeo. You are Orfeo Calzean, aren't you?
I am.
Uh-huh.
She nodded, her lips cut and swollen.
Look, Orfeo. I understand what you are. I know what you want. I have spent a week being tortured by that animal Siskind. He had Vonna's help. He was skilled. I have nothing left to tell.
The thing is, said Calzean, I actually believe you. Siskind is third generation Cognitae. He has tremendous invasive skills, and Vonna, well, Vonna is Vonna. I am truly sorry for you. The pains you must have endured. But the thing is, I think you might know more than you think you know.
I don't. Just kill me, Kara begged. Please don't hurt me any more. In the name of...
Kara, I don't intend to, said Calzean.
He drew something out of one of the drawers.
Do you know what this is?
I can't imagine.
It's a Kainbrach oculus. See?
He held it out in front of her. He showed her the head brace and made the colored lenses flip and exchange.
Surprisingly timid, the Kainbrach. Very cautious. Humanoid forms about so high.
He held out his hand in indication.
They like to know what was coming. Of course, they're long dead, so maybe this device has its limits, although I like to think that through such instruments they saw their impending doom. Anyway, where was I? Ah, yes. You look into this and,
he paused.
Kaleidoscopes. I had a kaleidoscope when I was a boy, he said.
Did you?
I was a girl. Funny, Kara. Did you? A kaleidoscope?
Yes.
Great, weren't they? The shuffling and the clattering. I loved that. I saw the galaxy through mine. What did you see, Kara?
Pretty patterns.
A Kainbrach oculus is very like that. It doesn't hurt. It just shows you the truth. Pretty patterns of truth.
Kara made a tiny moan. Both of them jumped as Calzean's link chimed. Taking it out of his pocket, Calzean looked at Kara and laughed.
My, my. Tense, aren't we? Must be the storm.
He put the link to his ear.
Yes, Layla.
We're tracking someone. A warm hit on the crack paths below us.
A shepherd, probably.
No, Orfeo, the link crackled. I'm waiting for confirmation, but I think we have a genuine biosign fix.
An identity? Who's coming to call at this late hour, Lay?
Try Calthonius.
Calzean blinked.
Track him. Arm the sentry guns and track him, Layla. Call me back the moment you have the confirmation.
Yes, sir.
Calzean closed the link. He looked back at Kara Swole.
You got a message off to your people, didn't you? Oh, you clever girl. You clever, pretty girl. And you hid that from Siskind and Vorna so well. What else are you concealing, Kara? Ravener's real fate, perhaps?
No, she said. That part is true.
There's something,
said Calzean gently, bending down to peer into her eyes. She could smell his sweet, clean breath and his hair oil. His eyes were almost kind, almost concerned for her well-being.
I can see it in you. Something.
Nothing.
He peered closer until the tips of their noses were almost touching.
I have been reading the languages of the body, face, and eyes for years, far longer than Siskind. He missed this, but I can see it. There's something wrapped up in that head of yours.
Please, I swear there's nothing else.
He rose. With steady, gentle hands, he fitted the Kynbrack device around her head, dropping the colored lenses over her eyes and arranging them carefully. The iron scalp brace sat like a barbarian's crown on her red hair. He buckled the straps under her chin. Content with the preparations, he stood back and stared at her.
"Relax," said Kalzean. "Let it do all the work."
Nothing happened for a moment. Kara sat, stock still, tensed for the worst. Then she began to twitch her head slightly every few seconds, flinching a little, as if to avoid some flying insect buzzing at her face.
"Kara,"
she murmured something. Her twitching became more accentuated. Her body jumped and jolted, like a blindfolded person, tormented by sounds darting about around them.
Make it stop,"
Kara said, her voice wobbling.
"Only when we're done," said Kalzean.
He placed a hand on her left shoulder to steady her.
"Look directly into it. Stop flinching away."
"No."
"Do it, please."
She began to tremble. The tremble was so spastic, it seemed to be prefiguring a grand mal seizure.
"Oh,"
she cried.
"Oh, oh, throne, oh, emperor."
"What do you see?"
Kalzean asked. She made a choking, gagging sound in her throat, as if she was about to retch. She writhed in the restraints.
"Tell me,"
he soothed.
"I remember. I remember."
Kara Swol shrieked.
"Kal!"
Then she began to scream.
On the lower south terrace of Elmengard, Siskind was celebrating. All of Kalzean's people not on duty that night had assembled. There were about 25 in all, hired guns, savants, and technical experts, and some of the senior domestics. They had taken dinner in the long room over the terrace, and had come out onto the terrace with drinks in their hands to watch the storm begin its slow, lusty tumble down the nightscape of the mountains. In a half hour or so, conditions would be too fierce and wet for them to remain outside, but just then there were only a few big raindrops in the air, propelled by the gathering wind. The revelers gathered amongst the fluttering taper lights and enjoyed the building light show of the storm. Lightning, blue-white and vivid, lanced around the crags of the Hog's Back, fixing its silhouette against the bleak night sky. Sheet electrics, a foggy, blinking radiance, underlit the bunching cloud wall. Siskind had already drunk too much. In a voice louder than any of the jovial voices on the north terrace, he was regaling some of the staff members with the tale of Ravenna's demise. Vorna, a bottle of Amasek in his fist, sat aloof at the end of the terrace, regarding the pitch-black drop into the flat country below. Moloch appeared beside him. He was dressed in black, with only his head and hands exposed. He loomed like a spectre.
"A notable night,"
Vorna rumbled, as if the thunder was speaking through him. Moloch half nodded.
"An achievement,"
Vorna added, taking a sip from his bottle. He offered it to Moloch, but Moloch shook his head. Vorna shrugged and said,
"I know this is a result you have longed for these many years. Your enemy is dead."
"Yes," said Moloch.
"You are pleased then, sir?"
Vorna asked.
"I am trying to allow myself a feeling of triumph,"
said Moloch quietly.
"I certainly thank you and the shipmaster for your sterling efforts. Ravenna has, as you remark, dogged me for more years than I care to recall. I have wished him dead so many times, yearned for it. I suppose now it is actually true. It feels like an anticlimax. It is often the way with things that are sought after for so long. Compared to the effort, the victory seems barren."
Vorna grunted.
"I know that one. Hunting a mark for months or years, and when you finally get the strike, it feels hollow and empty. But there's more to this, isn't there, if you don't mind me asking?"
Moloch glanced at the ancient bounty hunter and smiled an asymmetrical smile.
"You amuse me, Lucius. For all your brute demeanor, you exhibit a perceptive mind. Yes, there is more to this."
Moloch looked away as a particularly violent jag of lightning seared the peaks above. It seemed as if he were unwilling to say anything further. Then he glanced back at Vorna and said,
"There are dark days ahead, you see, Lucius. Dark even by our standards. Through Orfeo, I made Ravenna an offer. I have no love for him, you understand, but he was a very capable being. I believed that together we might avert the oncoming darkness. Ravenna chose to reject my offer. Now he is dead, and in no position to reconsider it. So, I suppose, I mourn his death as much as I celebrated.
Vorna shrugged.
I don't know, he considered. The crippled bastard was the enemy, when all was said and done.
There is another enemy, said Moloch.
He looked around.
Where's Kalzean? He usually enjoys this kind of merriment. I haven't seen him since the end of the meal.